discussing the ideas, the challenges, and the technology of the crypto economy. This is a Crypto Economy Chat. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Crypto Economy Podcast. We have got an interview today. We got a crypto chat with none other than Richard Myers. If you're not following Richard, you're failing. Richard is, he's been with Gotenna for quite some time now and has just started. There's a subsidiary of Gotenna now called Global Mesh Labs. And Richard Myers is heading that off, and he just wrote the white paper for Lot 49, a protocol based on the Lightning Network for incentivizing packet forwarding on a meshnet, on a decentralized infrastructure for a wireless alternative internet, And it's really, really exciting stuff. I have read through the whole white paper and trying to wrap my head around everything. And I've got the opportunity here to sit down and talk with Richard Myers. So I'm really, really excited to have him on the show. I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. We had a lot of fun with this. And I found out that he's been a longtime listener to the show, which is really exciting. So we will be jumping into that in just a second. Just so you know, this week is going to be a little bit crazy. I don't know when or how I'm going to release episodes. I will have this one today, and I think I will be able to get one scheduled for tomorrow, which is actually a conversation I had with Citizen Bitcoin, or with Brady on the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. But I have last minute yesterday, am scrambling and trying to get out. I have a flight out today. I'm going to San Francisco, and I'm going to make the Bitcoin 2019 conference. So I'm also trying to make sure that I have stuff so that I can record and do video and audio and maybe some interviews there in person. So hopefully I will be able to do a whole bunch of stuff. And since I'll be away from my computer, I might not have intros or outros. Not sure how it's going to go, but just stay tuned. We're going to have a bunch of fun stuff this week, hopefully. Fingers crossed. And but with that, let's go ahead and jump right into the interview with Richard Myers, all about his brand new protocol and white paper released on titled Lot 49, and all about incentivizing with Bitcoin and Lightning Network payments an alternative infrastructure, a decentralized infrastructure for the internet. All right, let's jump in. I have yet to actually get a Gotenna, and even though like I follow it very closely, I've not had a personal reason to do it, but this whole meshnet stuff is probably going to get me back into it and being like, okay, now I want one of these toys.
You're our target market with this.
Yeah, very much so. All right. Let's just go ahead and just start the show here then. We got Richard Myers on the show from Gotenna and now Global Mesh Labs, which is actually a subsidiary of Gotenna. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. Recently launched.
Cool. Okay. And why don't we just start, give me a breakdown of everything that you've kind of been doing with mesh networks and Gotenna, like up to now, what has kind of been the short version of how you got here?
Well, I don't know if I can make it short, but I'll give you the shorter version. So this whole Gotenna mesh and Bitcoin community collaboration, I would say, sort of started back in 2017 when Daniela gave a talk at the Block Stack, that's Stack Not Stream, conference, and basically sort of put out a call to arms. You know, she was looking for ways to use mesh networking to help sort of incentivize people to use mesh networking, but using you know, blockchain, Bitcoin to do that, and I heard that, and this was also about the same time that Blockstream was announcing their BlockSat project, so I put that together and, you know, just started talking to her about that. That's sort of how we met, And that has evolved into a series of projects to sort of explore the space, I would say, of Bitcoin and mesh networking. And also, you know, another interested party here was the Samurai Wallet team. And they started their Mule Tools project, again, with the same sort of inspiration of finding alternative communication layers to help support the Bitcoin network. So we talked to them, and they were the ones who first did the TXTenna app, which was the first kind of mesh Bitcoin project that we worked on. And what that allowed you to do is a mobile app on your Android phone, send and receive, send Bitcoin transactions. You would still need to have blockchain access to actually sort of confirm payments, but you could send from a completely off-grid phone. And that's available on the Android Play Store. So if anybody has a GoTenna mesh and wants to play with that, it's out there and you can give it a try. So that we announced, the Samurai team released that at the Hackers Conference in Prague last October, I believe it was. But then sort of as a follow-up to that, we continue to work on this. And the next sort of iteration was what we call TXTenna Python. And that was essentially the TXTenna mobile app, but running on Python, which allowed us to put it on like a single board computer, something like a Raspberry Pi, for example, or just your desktop PC also.
Okay.
And what that allowed you to do is, you know, the thinking there was you could have a gateway node to a gateway for your block, for your Bitcoin transactions. That could be a single board computer. It could be a PC. It could be some sort of always on full node, for example. It could be your own always on full node, your Noddle, for example, or your Casa home. And that could have a GoTenna mesh attached to it and be the receiver for Bitcoin transactions that are sent from your mobile phone running Samurai Wallet and the TXTenna app. So that was sort of the next phase of our evolution there. But pretty soon we got this idea that now wouldn't it be cool if that full node didn't have to have internet connectivity either. And so of course back to Blockstream and their Blockset, we thought, you know, this would actually be pretty cool. So we talked to them about that, and with the help of Grubbles there at Blockstream and a few other people helping us out, we were able to extend this TXTenna Python app to work on a off-grid BlockSat connected computer. And not only could you now use this to receive payments via the BlockSat, via your block, you know, block downloads, blocks and transaction downloads from the space, you could also send transactions now via the mesh in the same way that you would.
That's funny. I didn't know about this. I didn't know about this one. I had been following TXTenna or whatever. And
you got to be on Twitter more.
I thought I was on Twitter a lot. How did I not bump into the satellite one?
Yeah, we just announced this in May, actually, at the Magical Crypto Conference that those guys ran. So I was on panel.
You were
with,
there? What day did you speak?
This was day one, I believe.
Day one. Yeah, I missed day one. I was there. I was there, but I went to Pierre Richard's Lightning Workshop on Saturday.
That's too bad. Yeah. I should have known. If I'd known you were there, I would have given you an exclusive right there.
Exactly. Oh, man.
I'm bad about like thinking about that. But yeah, so we just announced that in May. So I was out in New York like a month ago. And yeah, so that's been kind of cool. But the cool thing about that wasn't just the idea of sending Bitcoin transactions, but I don't know how familiar you are with the BlockSat project, but they also have this ability to send API data, they call it. So API data just means that you could you can send just any random data to a API that they run on a server. And then they'll send you back an invoice on Lightning. And if you pay that invoice, they'll broadcast whatever message it is you want to send throughout the world over the BlockSat system. So what that allows you to do, so that's a cool project. You know, you get a basically anonymous communicate with the world through a satellite network. So not only did we support the ability to send Bitcoin transactions that were received from the BlockSat or from the full node there, but you could also rebroadcast this API data that's downloaded to a full node or downloaded to a BlockSat connected full node. So that kind of gets us to where we are now. And I mean, I'll go a little more into this later, but we're going to talk about Lot 49. So this starts to bridge us from just sending Bitcoin transactions, but to thinking about how to actually bridge mesh networks from a communication standpoint. So you could imagine sending to this API from your mesh network in, say, Los Angeles, and it goes over the satellite, and you're able to communicate with another mesh network that's maybe located in Brazil, say. So, you know,
oh, wow.
How do you bridge these local mesh networks?
And I was about to say, that becomes like your bridge node. You could use one of the satellites, the block sats or whatever, right, as a bridge node between like global mesh, like separate mesh nets.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's
interesting.
And there are other satellite systems out there, but the, you know, real cool aspect of this, you know, from our perspective, is it's paid for with Lightning payments and it's totally anonymous and, you know, reasonably censorship resistant. You can encrypt your communications as you want. So, so that's the, you know, long and short of where we're at up to this point. And then just recently, I think the reason you reached out was you heard about our announcement of the Global Mesh Labs, which is a subsidiary of GoTenna, which is really focusing on how to take the ideas behind Bitcoin and, you know, and off-chain payments that are, you know, pioneered by the Lightning Network, and use those to incentivize people to run nodes for communication purposes, not just for Bitcoin communication, but just general communication, and try to help, you know, use that technology in the community, frankly, to bootstrap a mesh communication network. So I think that pretty much, that's as short as I could make it.
that catches us up to current day.
Today.
Yeah, definitely. As soon as Lot 49 hit, this is probably going to be the thing that finally kicks me into like getting a satellite node up and running, because I have been meaning to for a while. I've got like 3 computers running with like a bunch of different software just so I can play around with stuff. I've just finally been digging into Wasabi Wallet, and I have been meaning to do a satellite node, but this is probably going to make me play around with it, because this is going to make me, God, it's going to make me buy stuff. I shouldn't buy stuff.
Well, I hope it's all right.
Yeah, I've had a satellite dish out back that my wife is like, we need to get rid of that thing. I was like, no, I need it for my Bitcoin node.
Oh, it killed me. I threw away 2 satellite dishes that I inherited when I moved into a new house, and it was before the BlockSat project. And I just kicking myself. I just took those to the dump, you know, like 3 or 4 years ago, and I
It's always the second you get rid of it that you find a use for it, right?
So true, so true. But they could be got secondhand, so we'll get another one.
Yeah, they're not hard to find. Okay, so before we get into like straight up Lot 49 stuff, which I really want to pick your brain, because I had a couple questions that I think the white paper answered, but obviously a lot of people, the people who are listening, probably didn't read the white paper. So what's your passion with this technology? Everybody's got a reason to be here, you know? And particularly with this technology, it always seems to be deeply kind of philosophical. There's like some really, like, I want to solve a problem in the world. And that's what I constantly find with everybody, is that they're here because they're like really passionate about something. What is it about meshnets and like this technology and making this kind of ubiquitous? What is it really that drives you, that makes this your thing?
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit that I was actually brought to mesh from Bitcoin. So, I mean, I was more of a Bitcoiner and then became a mesh advocate from that background. But I mean, it really, I think, goes back to the,
okay.
Yeah, so it really goes back to Twitter, I would say, and, you know, thinking about Blockstream and what they're doing. And I think it was actually a post I saw from Nick Szabo, who was talking about alternative communication layers. And that was shortly after I had heard Daniela talk about, you know, what she was looking for. And I think that just clicked in my mind, like, yes, this is a good win-win scenario for both of these technologies. And yeah, I mean, that was really the thing that drove me. But they share, both mesh networks and Bitcoin share this idea of a vision, I would say, sort of of decentralized communication. I mean, Bitcoin is just decentralized financial communication, but mesh networks basically, you know, they have the same properties. And that is the idea of censorship resistance, privacy, resilience, so that, you know, they're sort of not unstoppable technology. So all of these things, and also basically, you know, this idea of people power. This is something that Daniela says a lot about, a people powered network for mesh, but that definition fits for Bitcoin. You know, it is a people powered financial network. That's what drives me. I mean, that's what's driven me for quite a long time now.
Well, I was going to ask you what made you choose Bitcoin, but if you came to Bitcoin first and then went to MeshNet, that would be pretty obvious as to why you would choose Bitcoin.
Yeah, but it's still a good question though, because, you know, I was hired not to do this with Bitcoin per se. It was really to explore the problem, and we did explore a lot of other alternatives. You know, we looked at, because, you know, there are trade-offs that have to be made in any system like this. And I would say, from a technological standpoint, the thing that really drove us towards Bitcoin is the sort of focus. I think I've tweeted about this a little bit, the focus on reduced resource usage. I mean, that's something that it's very hard to find blockchain, you know, efforts that have such a strong focus on minimal resource use, and with the motivation of being decentralized. And that's very relevant for mesh networks, because there's inherent physical compromises you have to make between the range of the radio and the, I mean, you're familiar with mesh. There's the trade-off is between range, power, and bandwidth. So, you know, using Bitcoin was very much in line with a system that has to make trade-offs and has to favor sort of minimal resource use. In our case, it's, you know, power and bandwidth have to be minimized so that we can get maximum range, which is necessary to bootstrap a network, is to have very long range communication. And it's also short bursty communication, which also fits very well with the Bitcoin. And I mean, others also have that property, but that, from a technical standpoint, that was what I would say really attracted us to Bitcoin. But there's also a community aspect too, is that in that the community appreciates these things. The community appreciates decentralization. Not every cryptocurrency out there, you can say that. I'm sure you can think of a few that don't have decentralization top of mind.
Yeah.
So I think it's still a good question to ask, even though I came with a bias. I took me a long time to really be able to make the case that we could do this on Bitcoin and that it was the right choice. But I should also mention that Bitcoin, that even before I worked at Gotenna, they were accepting Bitcoin. You can buy Gotennas with Bitcoin as early as 2015. So obviously this interaction with Bitcoin has been going on before I got there as well.
Yeah, for quite a while. Yeah, that's one of the things that has like really just kind of fascinated me, in because it is so different from all the other blockchains and like projects and stuff out there, is the unbelievable focus on making all of the data, like shrinking all of the data and like the necessary bandwidth involved to keep the thing running. And it's always fascinated me. I remember watching just the amount of work that was put into over the years. I remember just watching a chart of the number of orphaned blocks that you would expect to find, and then just watching them like disappear, like orphans just almost stopped happening.
Yeah.
And it went from like you would have two or three blocks orphaned, and it was just because of the speed and latency was fixed to getting stuff across the network so fast that it just stopped happening. And it was funny, these little minor updates that everybody was just kind of ignoring. And I was just like, this thing's getting stronger and faster and more lean. And I definitely think you're right. Like, you know, if anything is going to work over a mesh net, obviously it has to be something that's incredibly lean and can move quickly and efficiently.
Yeah. And the current, you know, it's not just the past too. They really, you know, every major sort of proposal they have, you know, in the development community is really focused on that question. So it's, and when we talk more about Lot 49, I can sort of tell you how we're trying to incorporate that future direction as well.
Awesome. Yeah, there's some of the stuff that, like, talking about with L2 and Schnorr, that's really exciting. So why don't you go ahead, let's go ahead and just jump into Lot 49 here. Why don't you give me the layman's breakdown of what this is and what you think it will enable? All right, it's about time for a coffee break. So let's hit our sponsor really quick, and then we will jump back in with a deep dive into the Lot 49 protocol will enable.
Sure. So you have to think of this as sort of at the initial vision would be sending something like an SMS message. So you've got some sender on a mesh network who's disconnected from the internet. They don't have satellite connectivity. They don't have internet connectivity. But they have they're part of this mesh network. And what that means is they have a radio communication, say from their mobile phone, and they can communicate with somebody within range. And this is sort of just background on the mesh networking. And then if the person they want to talk to is out of range, then they will relay through somebody who is within range, and it'll hop from device to device, person to person, until it gets to the destination. So that's just sort of the nutshell on mesh. But if you're familiar with the Lightning Network, you can see there's some pretty close analogies there. The problem, I should say, with mesh networking is how do you make sure that there is somebody there? There's a node between you and your destination. How do you make sure that there's coverage? And that there's somebody there to relay your message and get it to where it needs to be. Current mesh technology really hasn't considered that. It's just if for instance, if you're a firefighter using a mesh radio, you're part of a team, and of course everybody leaves their radio on. But if we want this to grow to a globe-sized sort of project, you do need to give some people incentive to keep their mesh radio on. And that's sort of where the idea of an incentive protocol, the Lot 49 incentive protocol, came in. And you know, if you overlay how Lightning works, the way Lightning works is you open a channel with your nearest neighbor, and they open a channel with their neighbors. And when you want to make a payment from a sender to a receiver, your payment goes from node to node, and each node who relays that payment takes a little fee. So the mapping is pretty obvious at this point. You know, it's that now instead of sending a payment, you're just sending any sort of arbitrary data, any sort of message. And each node who doesn't just, they're actually relaying the data and collecting a small Lightning network fee to pass it on to the next guy. And when it actually reaches the destination, the destination also collects a small fee and in exchange returns a proof that they received it. And as that proof flows back through the network to the receipt, to the original sender, each node takes their payment. And if it's broken in any way, if for some reason one of those links goes down, as long as any of those nodes commit that proof or reveal that secret that it was received, then they can all collect their payments. So that's sort of Lightning, but think of this now overlaid on a mesh network. One other part of this, though, it's hard to make this sort of in layman's terms, but one thing to note that there are channels between adjacent nodes, and because they're making payments to each other, they have to have some communication with the payment network, at least initially. I mean, Lightning and the Lot 49 protocol is an off-chain protocol, but you need to establish these channels on-chain. So you will probably, there will be a step where you have to communicate over the mesh to a gateway initially when you open up a channel to anchor that channel. But then after that, your communications, your updated payments can happen without direct communication, you know, without any kind of communication to the internet or to the blockchain. And then when you close the transaction, you also need to somehow
do it between your nodes.
Yeah, so the updates happen purely between the nodes. And there's other details. There's some caveats there. But the majority of communication now can be just node to node. And that has two advantages. One is you don't have to have internet connectivity for every payment, but it also has the advantage that you can make very small payments and you're not creating, you know, this is the whole advantage of Lightning. You're not creating a lot of Bitcoin transactions with Bitcoin transaction fees and taking up block space and all that. So it's both from a communication standpoint, very efficient, but it's also from a block space perspective, very efficient. Just to recap. So you've got your sending node who prepays to send a message to some destination node. You've got relay nodes in between who take some of that prepayment in exchange for passing it on to the next guy until it gets to the destination. You've also got a gateway node, which is on both the internet somehow and on the mesh network, who is the link to the global Bitcoin network for anchoring these payment channels. And then we've got one other concept, which we can talk about later, maybe a little in the weeds, but we're not assuming that every node has internet connectivity. So you need some sort of a node to be your gateway, also to sort of handle the blockchain checking, to be kind of your full node in the cloud. To you think about this idea of light clients. Your mesh nodes are really light clients who have to communicate to what we're calling essentially a witness node, which they use to confirm payments and to get payments confirmed on the internet. So those are the pieces: senders, relays, receivers, gateways, and then these witness nodes.
Gotcha. Okay.
Is that enough, you think, detail?
Oh yeah. 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 I think that kind of gets, we definitely got the general idea to work from here. So with witness nodes, one thing I was pretty sure that I got this with the white paper, but they don't sync with, you ask witness nodes, like let's say I'm a normal like sender on the network and I'm asking for data from a witness node. I'm asking for specific data. Yeah. There, basically, Neutrino, even though Neutrino is light, we're still looking at megabytes of information there. And like, so I wouldn't be even downloading like block filters or anything like that. I would just be kind of getting a feel for like the immediate network around me and then asking for block data from a witness node, basically.
Yeah. So if you want to sort of put it in Bitcoin terms, the sort of lowest bandwidth way to communicate with the blockchain is through like a block explorer. So these witness nodes are a little bit analogous to a block explorer. So they do have to be trusted. So that's where there's trust in the system. However, you mentioned Neutrino, and we do believe that there is a place for removing that trust. And I mean, part of the way you can remove that trust is, for instance, to talk to a trusted node that maybe you run or that somebody in your family runs. So there are ways you can minimize that trust. But the most bandwidth efficient way is to have a full node out there that's a kind of equivalent to a block explorer, but maybe a little different than a block explorer in that they might send you back proof that can't be spoofed, or some way you can know that if they tell you a transaction is not or is on the blockchain, you know, you can trust that information. But the next sort of way to do that, to make it to make that trust more decentralized, would be to send something like these Neutrino block filters. And maybe it's only like a headers only kind of thing at first. But again, it's a little bit based on the bandwidth you've got to work with. And we're really trying to optimize the bandwidth. So I think your understanding was correct. We don't use block filters, but it is something we've talked about doing. And there's one other technology. There's quite a long list of things we'd like to look at. The other one is to use, in the future, it'll be possible to do something called channel factories. So this would allow you to open and close and monitor channels without going to the internet, or at least not directly, but to instead go to a channel factory, which are some sort of always-on mesh nodes, which sort of serve that purpose. It's a bit like the best sort of trustless way to do it.
Channel factories blow my mind. That white paper, like when that dropped, I was just like, holy crap, this is like, because it was immediately like we're looking at layers on top of like, or underneath Lightning and stuff. There's just so much crazy stuff there. The number of things that are constantly hitting that could probably be applied to this. is just kind of crazy. And I want to ask you about a couple, but I'm getting a little ahead of myself. One thing I did just want to ask was kind of what made you pick Lightning? What made you go, like, because there's a kind of a main complaint, I guess you could say, about Lightning is that you always have to be online. And in this case, you know, you have to be constantly checking a witness node or something that can talk to the blockchain to make sure that you're not getting cheated. When that's kind of the idea of Lightning, that you need to be online, what is it that really made you go, oh, this could be a solution? And was it something where you were like at first, okay, maybe not, but then you started playing with it and it looked like there was a possibility here? What was your thought process?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. We spent a long time sort of initially thinking about, is there a way to do this without any online blockchain access? I mean, that's kind of which you're saying, you know, like, is there a way to do this so that you don't have to touch bases with the blockchain? And, you know, in the world of alts, there's tangles and there's all sorts of like weird, crazy ideas out there. And just, and I looked at a lot of white papers and just to see if anybody had sort of had a solution to this. And, you know, there were some good ideas, probabilistic payments, all sorts of stuff. But at the end of the day, you really, if you're communicating with a global payment network, and not some just local payment network, there's no getting around it. You have to have some online access at some point. So then the question really becomes, how do you minimize your access to online communication and make that as minimal as possible? And that is basically the problem that Lightning was going to solve. You know, they're trying to create an off chain protocol that doesn't have to talk to the blockchain, except for in, you know, very specific situations. So there's trade-offs, and that's one of the trade-offs if you want a global payment system. If you really want something that isn't a fungible token that anybody can sort of redeem anywhere in the world, that opens up a lot of possibilities. You know, now you don't necessarily have that problem. But, you know, if you really want a global currency to be involved, then Lightning is sort of the most efficient way to get that done. And that's half the question. I mean, that's half the problem, because we looked at some technologies that were like Lightning, but were much more efficient. BLS signatures, you may have heard of, that's sort of a technology that some people have sort of proposed for Bitcoin. And it's essentially been, you know, rejected for reasons that I didn't really understand until pretty recently. But looking at that, we realized that even if we could get some modest increase or even significant increase in reducing the bandwidth, you give up a lot by giving up when you try to bootstrap your own crypto community in addition to your own mesh network.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, there was a very decision that we wanted not just the fantastic development community, but also the user community. And by, you know, that community has a very real and pressing need for this technology to communicate off grid, even if, you know, what they're communicating is payments. But that is kind of a seed for a community that is interested in this kind of off grid communication as well. So even if there is some trade-offs, we think the trade-offs are well worth it in order to be part of the community that can help us bootstrap this whole protocol.
Yeah, it's kind of you'd be in a situation where you're starting from scratch trying to get people like on this new infrastructure and development community and users who are excited about it. Whereas, you know, with Bitcoin, you've got everybody that's already interested in that in a very active and community where people are looking for exactly stuff like this. Like I scour the internet for exactly things like Lot 49 when stuff gets released. I love it and I dig into it, and this happens. So let's see. There was one question that I wanted to ask, because you talk about like setting up payment channels with nodes around you. And the question I kind of had was, if you saw this more of a kind of building an alternative network in the sense of like a more of a static global infrastructure that's decentralized, in the sense that like after you build it up, it's kind of there.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, there's a little pause there. Go ahead and finish your question. Sorry.
I was going to say, or do you think this is more oriented toward like bootstrapping a local, like temporary network, like a really quick ad hoc, like build it up in the case of like maybe a disaster scenario or something that's more temporary?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think really global mesh network, you know, like global mesh labs, that is our vision. But I think short term, you'll probably see these networks catch on more in places with local needs. You know, I think it's a network, a mesh network isn't truly like one mesh. It's going to be a mesh of meshes. So places where they have this need because of disasters or because of just shaky infrastructure or bad, you know, bad government, those places will maybe bootstrap these kind of networks first. And then, you know, we want a protocol that is able to scale those into a global mesh of meshes. So I think that's really the vision we have for this.
Now, with the whole like opening a channel, and I think the white paper seems to answer this, but I want to make sure that I'm clear on it, is that when is the message taking the exact same path as the Lightning payment, in the sense that if like obviously if I'm not connected to the internet, then I can't figure out like a Lightning route. But if I can get to a gateway node, then even if I'm not connected to the immediate node, like with a payment channel, technically I could route the Lightning payment to them as long as there was one available that like took three hops just to get my message one hop. But is that not are the Lightning payment and the message like inevitably linked?
In our design right now, they are. So it's a little different than the Lightning network, where your sort of communication network is over the internet, but it's really an overlay on some communication links you have no idea about. In our case, we're really thinking of these Lightning payments being synonymous with the actual communication channels that you're communicating over.
Okay.
So that is the difference, absolutely. And there are ways that we've there may be ways to do this where maybe you don't do that, but we're more worried about just making sure that people, that nodes that relay, can do it for free. So there may be some free relaying that goes on. I mean, for instance, if your destination is one hop away, you wouldn't obviously pay them to receive it because you don't have to go through a relay. But a relay is expanding their battery and their time, you know, their sort of their communication time to relay your message. So our vision is really that by default, at least, people would collect a payment. You know, that every relay would collect, it may be a very small payment, but that would be sort of a key to the network, is to make sure that people who are basically being providers of connectivity and bandwidth are being incentivized to be there.
Gotcha. So it's more like you hope, like as a node comes on, you want to be able, your goal is to get them to incentivize to stay there, like so that they continue to be available, like ongoing.
Yeah, that's the idea. And that people, you know, who are more, you know, your average person, maybe they don't collect payments more than they need to make their own payments. I mean, in a well-connected network, it probably balances out. And that's also a way to make sure that you don't get sort of a tragedy of the commons where somebody is doing nothing but sending their own messages, but never, you know, they have some hacked client that never broadcasts for anyone else. So, you know, it's a way to kind of solve that problem as well. In a very, you know, in where mesh is really successful, you don't want people to sort of abuse the system. Right now, we're really in a bootstrap phase and you don't really get that issue so much. But it is something that it's a side effect of having incentive, is that it limits people's ability to sort of take but not give back. But there's one, you know, the one thing is just the person who's just using the system. They're keeping it on because they want to collect some payments, but they're probably not becoming net, you know, they don't generate a lot of extra income. But then there might be other people who really seek that out. They run one in the window of their house, or they, you know, maybe they know that there's always a lot of traffic between point A and point B, and they want to make sure and set up a node there in a tree or something. you know, those people, they might end up being, you know, more net gainers of this. And that's the same way, a centralized ISP scouts out where they should put their, equipment. And those are the people you want to get, you know, be net receivers of payments because they're actually building the network without being coordinated except for by these incentives.
With that in mind, like when you're talking about the example of like somebody putting one in their window or something, what's the, for the kind of the low bandwidth, like high distance, like low frequency stuff that you're working with, like let's take GoTenna for example, what would you expect for a connection range if I did that in a residential area and just set one up like on the corner of my house or something?
I mean,
with
it's
a
very
box
hard. Yeah. I mean, as you say, you've like studied mesh a little bit. I mean, it's very going to be environmental, you know, what mm-hmm. the local surroundings are to determine the range. I think on our website, the GoTenna is specced out at like 4 mile range, something like that. But that's probably pretty ideal conditions. I think, you know, if you're up high, that increases your range quite a lot. So if you were at the top of an apartment building, for example, you get much better range than if you were in the middle of like kind of a concrete jungle like New York on the ground level. But I think, you know, like minimum, I would say like 800, 800 meters. I don't know what that is in feet actually. I walk around my neighborhood, which is just sort of a suburban area, and I get about 1.6 kilometers.
That's not bad.
Yeah. So it's pretty good. Yeah. So that's without putting it up in a tree or anything. That's just literally hanging it out putting it in my window. And then I go for a run and I kind of check back and see how much range I got. So, without doing anything special, you get, and you know, if you compare that to Wi-Fi, for example, it's a huge difference.
Yeah. Wi-Fi, you're at the end of the driveway and it's spotty.
Yeah. So it's a big change, and you take a hit on bandwidth, but that is the trade-off we make, is to increase the range.
One thing you talked about with, Stefan that I thought was really cool, just because, it was always one of those things that, was kind of front and center with like BitTorrent and like the other peer-to-peer networks, was kind of the idea of a gamification of it. Like even if you're not like really making money, you get to see these like points essentially for what you've provided for the network. Whether you seed, you're a seeder or a leecher, you know, how it is on BitTorrent or something. And I thought that was a really interesting idea. What were your kind of thoughts on that? Like, is that something you think is powerful, even if it's not straight up monetary in a sense?
For sure. I mean, I think anybody who's run their own Lightning node has had that experience of, you know, receiving a few Satoshis for, you know, your first few Satoshis relayed. And even though if you were to do the math, that would be pretty small change, like micro change. There's a real feeling of, you know, being part of the network and, you know, really accomplishing something. I mean, Alex Bosworth would probably not agree that that's going to be a financially viable model, but it is true that at least initially to jumpstart a network, that's a very significant way you get people to kind of participate. Now that's, you know, that may not be enough to grow a huge network, but it's definitely a way to bootstrap it, I would say. And one of the, I think I mentioned earlier, one of the most requested features of the current GoTenna, which has no incentives at all, is just to know if your node has relayed for anybody. People want to know on their app if somebody's, you know, relayed. So, and that would not be for money, but they, you know, I think that if we add that, that's something that would encourage people to leave their nodes on, just to know that they're actually providing for other people. You mentioned BitTorrent. It's interesting too, because there's a funny phenomenon too, where BitTorrent, you're right, they had this sort of gamification and upload download ratios, things like that. But once the network hits a critical mass, it isn't quite as important. You know, there's an interesting phenomena where you pass some point of critical mass, and you know, there may still be this idea of upload download ratios, just in some way. I don't know the details of how it works now, but I think it's a lot less significant now that you've got so many people who are just coming online to provide, you know, provide network coverage. And I see that happening for mesh too. I mean, you probably will always have some nodes that really require payment to be gateways, or nodes that require or earn an excess of credits for doing certain things. But I think your average user is really gonna sort of net out, and if they have a really well connected network and they don't have their only payment is to provide for other people, now you're talking about a real game changer as far as people's conception of communication. Like, they're not paying a monthly bill for this essential level of communication. They can actually have it for free just by providing network coverage for everyone else.
I think that's
a powerful motivator.
It's really interesting because I haven't specifically said I wanted that feature, but I know I would be in that pool because I fought really hard to figure out how to log into my Casa by command line to see if I had actually routed anything. And I remember it took me a month. I couldn't figure out why I wasn't routing anything. And I was stupid. It was just because all my stuff was balanced to one side. And then after I finally bought a bunch of stickers and stuff, I remember I got so excited because I was checking every 2 or 3 days, I was logging in and waiting for that thing. And I saw my first routed payment. It was 100 Satoshis. I was so happy. I was proud.
Felt it.
At what point is the code worked out for this thing? As far as the design, is this all just we're working it out and thinking about it all? Or has some of this actually been written? Have y'all been playing with stuff at this point already?
Yeah, well, where we're at now is most of the design is on paper. I mean, most of the work has really just been on researching and putting this down on paper. But in addition, I have started some simulations. So unfortunately, they're all in GitHub. So if you go to the Lot 49 directory, you can see sort of my musings in code on how this would, mostly looking at things like the bandwidth, because that's our real number one concern. Now, most code that's out there now used the BLS signature scheme, which is something that I was, the last thing I was pursuing. But we have a project for this summer to really look at getting that updated to use MuSig, because now this wasn't available when I first started doing this modeling. But now that Peter Willa et al. Have come up with a library, their SEC 256P. I forget exactly, but they have a library now that allows you to try out MuSig. We've got an intern, a real smart guy working on it this summer, who's going to try to update to basically match the white paper with MuSig and a kind of cartoon version of L2. It's not, I wouldn't say an implementation. It's just a kind of cartoonification of it. Just kind of to get an idea how this dynamics of the network work. But I think once we use that simulation, we'll use that to sort of refine what we're doing and figure out what we need to, kind of the approach we need to take when we go ahead and implement it. And we'd like to move pretty quick to get at least a very basic proof of concept out that we can start playing with. But right now, simulation only.
Gotcha. Okay. I think there was something in the white paper about saying that y'all were going to set up a Bitcoin test net. The plan was to do a testnet with Schnorr and L2 and everything. And then basically y'all would be a centralized backer for the Bitcoin testnet token or whatever, just to play around and bootstrap it in the kind of the experiment phase.
Yeah, that's an idea I've had we're not expecting to see, BIP Taproot and Schnorr and all that really cool stuff anytime soon. I mean, we hope it's soon. We hope it's sooner than it took to get SegWit. But realistically, these things are complex and they take time. So in the meantime, our goal would be to just probably get more, a cartoon version of this stuff initially. And then as these things get implemented in testnet, start to move over to testnet to the point where we can to run some tests. And I mean, by tests, I just mean say take New York or, take lower Manhattan and say, okay, we're going to run a test here. And maybe you get points, you get t-shirts or something, or you get hats if you can be the one who routed the most packets or you're the one who opened the most channels. kind of thing, just to try it out and just try to create some real world, I mean, somewhat contrived, but a little more real world testing on what the interface between actual like radio mesh and Lightning payments looks like. So that's a goal I have for the next, you know, I don't know if I can say by the end of this year, but it's something I'd like to do sooner than later, just so we can get people's kind of experience with it and see how it works when it meets reality a little.
Well, I'll make sure to watch it a lot more closely this time so I don't miss it. And this will probably be my excuse to set up my satellite here.
Great.
Now with L2 fascinates me, and I don't quite get it. I have a really hard time wrapping my head around exactly how that works. And you said something on in the interview with Stefan that, like, so the current updating a payment channel or whatever requires kind of a back and forth, right, between you and the other person in the channel. And I believe you said that L2 allows you to basically just make a one-sided update, that you can just push it, and the other, as long as the other person receives it, they accept it. Can you tell me, maybe I misunderstood that, but what?
No. You got it. I mean, this is a little bit, you know, something that we'll need to get confirmed more. But when you look at the L2 protocol, it's different than the current Lightning protocol in a pretty significant way, in that the way it works in the current system is you've got these channels we talked about. And when I make a payment to you, we update the state of that channel so that you know, so that the payee gets, you know, say another Satoshi, say. But for you to confirm that state, both the payer and the payee need to basically sign some transactions to make that the current state. They need to essentially, what they're doing is they're revoking the last state and signing a new state. And it's not a symmetric. So there's the transaction that the payer holds is different than the transaction that the payee holds. So they both need to sign something. Well, that's not exactly true in L2. In L2, there's only one transaction that they both sign. So that means that if the payer signs it and gives it to the payee can stick that in their back pocket. And they can always drop it onto the network if they need to, but they don't need to send their signature back to the payer. The payer still has an older transaction where that payment never happened, and they'll be happy to drop that. And because there's no penalty, there's no harm if the payer drops an out-of-date payment, essentially. So both sides, with the payer signing to the payee, you've got an update to the state, and there's no penalty for either of them to drop that transaction. There's a little bit of a penalty in that the payer doesn't want to pay it now to, you know, they don't want to pay the transaction cost perhaps, but it isn't required for every update that they sign two transactions. They can just sign it, send it to the payer and the payee, the one that receives the Satoshi, they can just keep it in their pocket. And most of these update channels are going to have multiple rounds of communication or multiple updates. So as soon as you update to the next date, then the half signed transaction that can just be forgotten. That's a unique quality that L2 has, is that you don't have to keep, because there's no penalty phase. You don't have to keep old transactions just in case your counterparty drops an out of date state for the network. So you only need the tip, the one that's the last sort of update, but really it's only the person receiving the last payment that needs to keep the most up-to-date part of it. The one who was doing the paying could just keep the last time they got a payment, and that'd be a little out of sync, but in the worst case is they have to pay a transaction fee if because they might drop that transaction, and then the one who had the more positive balance could also drop their transaction and supersede it, but there's no penalty, so at worst, they just lose some transaction fee. But from a network standpoint, you're really cutting down a lot of communication. And that was really, once I understood that to be true, that was a real attractive feature of L2.
Yeah, it seems like it's actually a really good pair with the idea of a meshnet in general, just because you have a whole lot less concern with you know, maybe faulty hardware, or because there's no actual punishment clause in the updates anymore. It's just a new state revokes the old state. It seems like a much more cooperative setup rather than a we're at each other's throats if something goes wrong setup, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely different philosophies about that. I know Peter Todd has a little different view.
Yeah. A
little bit. But it, you know, there's always trade-offs. You know, something that's a theme on Twitter lately is there's got to be trade-offs. And this I think, is a reasonable trade-off, at least in our situation, to make. And there's some really cool stuff coming out. I mean, you mentioned L2. And what does L2 need? L2 needs Schnorr. Actually, it doesn't need Schnorr, actually. It needs the no input BIP. But now SIG hash no input. I recently read now that there's another proposal that may replace SIG hash no input called it's the BIP any previous out, if you want to look that one up. And what's cool about that is that
I'll check that one out.
Pretty recent. And that's that BIP basically builds on the taproot BIP, which builds on the Schnorr BIP. So that Schnorr BIP and the taproot BIP are going to be a package, it seems. That seems to be like how that's going to come down. But once those are accepted by the network, any previous out could be pretty easily soft forked on top of that infrastructure. And what you gain from that is all the advantages of taproot as far as hiding the scripts and making the sort of taproot assumption where, and this is true for Lightning. And I mean, this is, people are doing this on purpose to help Lightning, or I've been talking about this, that in a collaborative close for Lightning, an aggregated signature where using something like MuSig, it could look like a single signature. So, that's a little in the weeds, but anyway, I'm just saying that the combination of taproot with L2 and this any previous out, it's something that would help us, I believe, with what we want to do as well. So it's cool to see that that's the direction that it seems the development community is headed.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear, like when they were talking about like basically every Lightning channel opening or closing could be a taproot transaction, and then like you're aggregating signatures in that, and then also like you could pull it together with like multiple people opening and closing channels at the same time. Like the number of different things that are at work and all of this, it's so hard to keep up. I had no idea about the any previous out, so I'm gonna have to dig into that now. With Watchtowers just hit recently. Right. And then there's also trampoline payments that I feel like are pretty recent, or at least I heard about them recently. Are Watchtower, are your witness nodes essentially behaving like Watchtowers? Will they actually be running kind of like the Watchtower like service, I guess you could say? Is that what you expect them to be doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I wrote a little bit about Watchtowers in the white paper, but there's certain trade-offs that are hard to make in a mesh network that are easier to make with like the traditional Lightning payments. So in a traditional, my understanding of the traditional vision for Watchtowers is every time you make an update, you can send something, or maybe when you go offline, I guess in one extreme, when you go offline, you can send something to a Watchtower. And then when you're offline, the Watchtower is watching for this out-of-date close of the channel. So you could definitely do something like that with L2 or with the mesh networks. And what you would be doing is you'd just be sending the last update, but with some sort of a way in which it isn't dropped on the network unless the previous or some previous transaction some out-of-date update is also sent. But I think maybe the difference there is that you wouldn't have to send every update. You could just send the last one, because I believe that's a difference. I have to think about it a little more. Honestly, I'm not I'm not as familiar with the watchtower logic, but just because I'm thinking that with Lightning, you have to keep every intermediate state, or you have to keep every update, so you know, or at least all the penalty information, so that any update transaction that happens to get on the network, you can penalize. So that's why I think that penalty information also has to make it to the watchtower. Where with L2, you can really just send the last one, so you can do it in a little less synchronous fashion. If you missed one of those updates to your watchtower, and that's the one they dropped on the network while you were sleeping, you wouldn't get your penalty. But that's not true. You could, as long as you send the most up to date one before you go offline, for example, to the watchtower with L2, that I believe would be enough. So for our mesh standpoint, I think that using watchtowers that would help. But it isn't what witness nodes do. Like I said, sort of witness nodes are, you really have to think about them a little more as block explorers. There's somebody who you query for transactions that you're interested in, and some block explorers also have the ability to drop a transaction on the network and tell you if that transaction's confirmed. So that's sort of the purpose. But I think that's really the way to think of the witness nodes at this point.
Gotcha. All right, what do you think right now? Like, with how much you've like tried to wrap your head around like this thing working, what's the biggest hurdle right now? The thing that you think needs to be focused on more than anything else to get solved? Where do you think its biggest limitation will be right now?
It depends a little on who you ask. I mean, obviously from a security standpoint, the necessity to go through a gateway, even though it's not really something you can avoid, is something that is a concern. You know, the fact that you have to go through these witness nodes, that you have to go through a gateway. Just technically speaking, that's the part we'd like to most get rid of. And there's some kind of interesting things just very recently coming out. I can't think of the guy's name right now, but they're looking at doing it's Stepan. Stepan Snigiryev. He's doing. All right, I didn't say that. Sorry, Stepan, I didn't say it correctly. But it's the term is spontaneous payments. They're doing something called spontaneous payments in Lightning, and there might be something in there. There might be some ways to at least minimize that dependence on the gateways. Although honestly, probably it's going to be something like the payment factories or channel factories that are really going to solve that. But that's sort of that's all kind of like technical stuff. I really think community is the real weak link in any mesh project, is how do you get a critical mass of people to run it? That's just unavoidable. I mean, we want to make it as technically sound as possible, but I think that's going to be an evolving solution. But from just a getting started standpoint, getting the community buy-in and getting people who want to do this and are fanatical about doing this, that's sort of what we need.
Yeah. If you can get the infrastructure and the community working with it and basically have something, a bootstrap network to start from, it's like the technical problems are technical problems at that point, you know?
We know Lightning.
Yeah, I can see how that's.
Yeah, Lightning is a good solution, and so we feel like that's at least a good direction. But even Lightning, you had to be reckless, right, to get started.
Yeah. Okay. In fact, that actually kind of leads me to I wanted to ask about, because it talked about basically when the network is first getting set up, that everything floods, like all the messages are basically sent out as flood because, you know, you don't really know what's going on with the mesh network around you. But then as channels or like paths get established, you start like sending on specific routes. Now, are your actual nodes, like let's say I'm in a node with like a group in my neighborhood, and like, am I actually building my own little, like layout of my local mesh network and like storing their public keys so that I can send them payments and then finding a path before I send a payment? Or do I actually like push it out to the other nodes and then wait for are they trying to find the path to my destination? or am I doing it first before I send the payment?
Yeah, that's something I probably should be a little more explicit about. I mean, I don't talk a lot about the routing aspect. We really talk mostly about payments. And that's because we're really assuming the routing is happening in a different subsystem of the, you know, unrelated to the payments at this point. So the way you find your destination node is there's a routing protocol. And that's, at least in the GoTenna sense, you know, that's something we've really spent a lot of time optimizing for this low bandwidth, low power kind of technology. But you would get the route. So you just can, right now it's a black box, you get the route. The fan out or the sort of broadcast you're talking about is, it's like, you know, it's how you advertise that you would like to make or that you're available to accept channels. And there's a little analogy to Lightning, but I the part you're talking about is where a node can basically half sign the, in the Lightning sense, it's like you half sign it by the refund transaction to establish a channel. And that's kind of the way you also broadcast the fact that you're willing to route for people. But that means that once somebody knows that they need to use you, they've already got half the message they need to establish that channel. So they can, it's really just optimization. It's an optimization to make sure that they, that when you want to open a channel with somebody, you already have half of what you need to open a channel with them and make sure that it's safe to get a refund if they just drop away at that point. But it's a little different than Lightning, but there are analogies.
Gotcha. Okay. In fact, there was this one thing towards the end of, it was in Future Work, I think. Hold on a second. Where is it? Geographic sharding. Yes. Okay. Now this blows my mind. Okay. So allow mesh nodes to lock payments to specific geographic areas. How on earth do you do that?
Yeah, that was an idea I had. How do I explain what I mean there, though? I guess insight that I had, hopefully I'm not totally wrong about this, is that every node in the mesh that is within a certain geographic area, they know, you know, a priori, they can check their own GPS and know what area they're in, what geo area they're in. So they could, and you could also, when you sort of advertise your information, so there's a step where you basically download a registry of people's kind of mesh ID and what their public key is for that mesh ID. They could also advertise their geolocation. And what that would mean is that now you've got sort of public keys, payment addresses, if you will, tied to geographical areas. Could be really large geographical areas. It could be like Southern California or New York. And if somebody tries to pay you with an address that's not marked for your geographical area, you would just ignore them. You know, they have to be in your geographic area. And the advantage I was looking for there is when you do start to look at things like for instance, the idea of these block filters, the neutrino 157, 158 neutrino block filters, those are based on the amount of information in the block. But if you knew that you were broadcasting that filter in a particular geographic area, you would only have to really include potentially, or maybe there's some way at least to just include the blocks within your geographic area. So it could be a smaller amount of information. That's kind of where I was going with that.
Yeah, that was just, I saw that and I was like, wait, really? I don't know. I just, that's such an interesting idea to me. I wouldn't have thought of that. What do you think, like with this thing, I mean, obviously we're talking about, you know, always having the ability to send messages like available, no matter kind of, you know, what happens with censorship or surveillance in, you know, the alternative network. And I love the idea of like connecting this to satellite nodes. So we're bridging across, you know, countries or whatever. We're taking some meshnet in city A and connecting it to meshnet in city B. But what do you see? What is your vision for? Do you have some like specific application that you kind of dream of that would be possible in this? Or is it just kind of the general idea of no censorship, no surveillance type thing?
Yeah. I mean, it would be nice not to have to pay a phone bill. I mean, because you can really, if the technology you have in your pocket right now, your mobile phone, it can communicate with other mobile phones. I mean, it just from a brass tacks, it's got a battery, it's got a radio, it can transceive information. Right now, it's just locked to only talking to the cell phone tower. And that's mm-hmm. because of the fact that only these centralized, you know, ISPs can buy the spectrum. But I mean, my vision would be that, you know, there's enough take up in these technologies, enough take up in mesh, that people demand cell phone quality bandwidth and cell phone quality spectrum, essentially, you know, highly valued spectrum as a public resource that they can use for mesh communication. So you're not just dealing with SMS messages, but all your mess, you know, all your data is basically able to be handled this way. So, I mean, if you really want to talk blue sky ideas or, you know, wild, crazy haired ideas, that's sort of like, that's out there. That's one of my thoughts on when I look at this stuff. But what you said about censorship resistance, anti-authoritarian, you know, technology, and enabling technologies, decentralized technologies like Bitcoin, I think that's really what drives me to do this, is those thoughts. And that's why maybe, you know, New York isn't the first market it's going to really catch on. It may be somewhere in Africa or somewhere in South America where this, you know, where they have really, really bad alternatives for communication, where this stuff gets started and maybe really gets a foothold. And just like they talk about Africa sort of leapfrogging the developed world as far as, you know, going straight to cell phones and not having wired telephones or wired internet. Maybe a place like that could also leapfrog the developed world as far as being like real pioneers in mesh communication. So yeah, I think that's really what my big vision would be if I were to say it.
That would be amazing to see, like particularly with like the whole idea of like as the third world kind of becomes part of the global economy, the fact that they're getting like I've read so many stories about like places in Africa that get cheap cell phones before they get clean water. And then just the ability to communicate like makes it like when one town nearby like actually gets some sort of source of water or shipment of food or something, that they can immediately communicate with villages around them that, you know, might be 2 miles away, 3 miles away or something. And then everybody comes and the distribution of the goods and the water happen at an incredible pace because they're skipping. They don't have to lay phone lines and then upgrade it to bandwidth and or cable lines and then, you know, put up cell towers. Like they're kind of immediately, they jump 80 years of development, and something like this could be huge because they don't have any alternatives. And this, something like this would be the cheap, like ad hoc solution that could be provided. Like I think there's a lot of potential there, and that's like one of the things that really excites me about it.
Yeah, cool.
So yeah, I've always loved this stuff, and I've always kind of had something in the back of my mind that like I always want to go back and like look and study mesh nets again, because I knew there is such potential there. I mean, you talk about everybody's mobile phones is basically infrastructure. Like we have devices everywhere that could participate. Mm-hmm. It's just like they're sitting stagnant. You know, they're not being used for the incredible potential they could have. So I'm excited that people like you and Global Mesh Labs are on that task so that I don't have to to focus on it. I can just read about the new updates.
We need you too. You're going to be a node, so.
Oh, I'll be there. I'll be a node. I can do that. That's a lot easier. I'll test out all the software and I'll make podcast episodes about it.
Excellent. That's really great.
All right. So for all the people who care about privacy, sovereignty, network independence, all of these great things, what can they do to participate, to help out? Like, how can they follow you, stay up to date on this? Give me the drop on all the good stuff.
All right. Well, I mean, so Global Mesh Labs, you can go to globalmeshlabs.org. That's where we're going to be posting, you know, our progress on this project. You know, if we do any sort of tests or we have things you can test, white papers posted there. Really encourage people to go there. If you want email updates, you can sign up for email updates. We also have a Telegram group that you can link to from there. Just if you want to geek out about this stuff with other like-minded people. And we're also on Twitter, Global Mesh Labs. So follow us there. We're going to, you know, keep everybody up to date as we move along. And I am R.E. Myers_ on Twitter. And I post a few things. And if you want to just follow what I'm up to, you can definitely check that out. But yeah, just if your question was, what can people do, follow us, but also give us feedback, read the white paper. I mean, I think that's great that you read it, Guy, and have given us feedback. Just questions even are good to get, because it's an open source project. It's also an open source white paper. If you have something that seemed unclear, do a pull request or mention it to me, and I can make a change, because we want to get as many people looking at this and giving us feedback on this as we can. Not just the development community, but the user community, how people talking about how they would use it or what might not work for them. That's very useful feedback as we try to make this a real thing in the world.
Yeah, I can do that. Where's, you said the y'all got a Telegram running. I'm a big user of Telegram. Where is the link to that? Is that on Global Mesh Labs?
Yeah, go to globalmeshlabs.org. It's down at the bottom somewhere. We've got a Telegram. I think we've got a
Stay connected. Telegram. There you are. Okay. All right. Sweet. I am going to jump in now. Telegram. So,
it's been a little quiet, but I think people are still digesting.
All right. Awesome. I am in the Telegram. Love it. And I will drop all the links for that. I'll source all this stuff. Was there anything else you wanted to add here at the end of this thing? Something specific? Call to action.
That's it. The call to action is read the white paper, give us feedback. Try out TXTenna if you're interested in that, because I think that the ability to do that is sort of, we're going to be building on that platform, and that's going to evolve, I hope. Parts of the concepts we use there are going to evolve into this. So give that a try and let us know what you think.
Awesome. I can't believe you're going to make me buy a GoTenna. I've been putting that off for a long time, and now I got
to
play.
You'll have lots of uses for it, I hope.
Awesome. Well, dude, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was a blast. I've been utterly fascinated with this, and I'm going to be following this really, really closely. And as things start happening, I'm probably going to reach out again, and we're going to talk about this again. And I'm going to try to have my satellite node and my GoTenna up the next time, so we can jab about that.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to get my satellite up too. We can geek out on that. Thanks so much. I've been a big fan of your podcast.
Yes.
A long time, so it's been a pleasure speaking to you.
No kidding, really?
Oh yeah, a long.
You're a long time listener.
A long time listener, first time caller though.
First time caller, love it. Awesome, thanks so much, Richard. It's a pleasure.
Sure. Bye bye.
And that will wrap us up for today. Don't forget to follow Richard Myers. That was at R.E. Myers_ on Twitter. I'll post the link to the Telegram, so that you can ask any other questions to the group. Globalmeshlabs.org. GoTenna, if you're looking at getting your GoTenna device that will help in getting to experiment with this, I'll actually link to the BlockSat project as well, just because we talked about that quite a bit. And then, of course, his Twitter tag. So be sure to check out the show notes where you'll get all of these links so that you can go digging further into this. You can check out the white paper if you want to dig it, because there's a lot of stuff. There's like future work and like other ideas that go into. Obviously, we could not cover the entire white paper. It was a pretty long and in-depth piece of work there. So I encourage you guys to check that out. Join the Telegram and get involved in the conversation, because I think this is going to be a really fun project that we should keep a really close eye on going forward. So thank you guys so much. Another thank you to Richard Myers for coming on the show. I had a fun time talking all about the new decentralized meshnet that we hope to build and powering it with Lightning. I think we have a ton of ideas to work off from here. And with the continuous progress of Lightning, I think these things are just going to get better and more capable. So with that, don't forget to follow me. I am at The Crypto Economy on Twitter. And subscribe to the show so you don't miss anything else that we do. We have so much stuff coming. And like I said, this week is going to be crazy. We got Bitcoin 2019 conference. The price is going nuts. Number go up. And yeah, don't forget to share this out with anybody else you want, who you think is interested in Bitcoin and the crypto economy, who wants to know about being sovereign and independent and wants to know about how to reclaim their privacy. This is the place to hear about all of it. How do we build a decentralized internet? How do we find the solutions to these problems in the world? Because they're out there. People are building them. People are experimenting with all these all new protocols and new systems to make this stuff possible. And that is what we talk about. That is what we explore here at the Crypto Economy Podcast with your host, myself, Guy Swan. And thank you for listening, guys. Don't forget to share this out. That is what makes this show happen. Until next time, take it easy, guys.